Stein, Hahn, and Meitner, among others, in Berlin. But the war intervened. A reserve officer, Geiger, was called up early. He fortified Chadwick with a personal check for 200 marks before he left. Some of the young Englishman's German friends advised him to leave the country quickly, but others convinced him to wait to avoid the danger of encountering troop trains along the way. On August 2nd, Chadwick tried to buy a ticket home by way of Holland at the Cook's Tours office in Berlin. Cook's suggested going through Switzerland instead. That struck Chadwick's friends as risky. He again accepted their advice and settled in to wait. Then it was too late. He was arrested along with a German friend for allegedly making subversive remarks. Merely speaking English would have done the job in those first weeks of hysterical nationalism, and languished in a Berlin jail for 10 days before Geiger's laboratory arranged his release. Once out, he returned to the laboratory until chaos retreated behind order again, and the Kaiser's government found time to direct that all Englishmen in Germany be interned for the duration of the war. The place of internment was a racetrack at Ruhleben. The name means quiet life, near Spandau. Chadwick shared with 5 other men a box stall designed for 2 horses, and must have thought of Gulliver. In the winter, he had to stamp his feet till late morning before they thawed. He and other interns formed a scientific society and even managed to conduct experiments. Chadwick's cold, hungry, quiet life at Ruhleben continued for 4 interminable years. This was the time, he said later, making the best of it, when he really began to grow up. He returned to Manchester after the armistice with his digestion ruined and 11 pounds in his pocket. He was at least alive, unlike poor Harry Moseley. Rutherford took him in. Some of the experiments Chadwick conducted at the Cavendish in the 1920s to look for the neutron, he says, were so desperate, so far-fetched, as to belong to the days of alchemy. He and Rutherford both thought of the neutron, as Rutherford had imagined it in his Beccarian lecture, as a close union of proton and electron. They therefore conjured up various ways to torture hydrogen, blasting it with electrical discharges, searching out the effects on it of passing cosmic rays, in the hope that the H atom that had been stable since the early days of the universe would somehow agree to collapse into neutrality at their hands. The neutral particle resisted their blandishments, and the nucleus resisted attack. The laboratory, Chadwick remembers, passed through a relatively quiet spell. Much interesting and important work was done, but it was work of consolidation rather than of discovery. In spite of many attempts, the paths to new fields could not be found. It began to seem, he adds, that the problem of the new structure of the nucleus might indeed have to be left to the next generation, as Rutherford had once said, and as many physicists continued to believe. Rutherford was a little disappointed, because it was so very difficult to find out anything really important. Quantum theory bloomed while nuclear studies stalled. Rutherford had felt optimistic enough in 1923 to shout at the annual meeting of the British Association, "We are living in the heroic age of physics." By 1927, in a paper on atomic structure, he was a little less confident. "We are not yet able to do more than guess at the structure, even of the lighter and presumably least complex atoms," he writes. He proposed a structure, nonetheless, with electrons in the nucleus orbiting around nuclear protons, an atom within an atom. They had other work. In hindsight, it was necessary preparation. The scintillation method of detecting radiation had reached its limit of effectiveness. It was unreliable if the counting rate was greater than 150 per minute or less than about 3 per minute. And both ranges now came into view in nuclear studies. A disagreement between the Cavendish and the Vienna Radium Institute convinced even Rutherford of the necessity of change. Vienna had reproduced the Cavendish's light element disintegration experiments and published completely different results. Worse, the Vienna physicists attributed the discrepancy to inferior Cavendish equipment. Chadwick laboriously reran the experiments with a specially made microscope with zinc sulfide coated directly onto the lens of the microscope's objective, which greatly brightened the field. The results confirmed the Cavendish's earlier count. Chadwick then went to Vienna. He found, write his biographers, that the scintillation counting was done by three young women. It was thought that not only did women have better eyes than men, but they were less likely to be distracted by thinking while counting. Chadwick observed the young women at work and realized that because they understood what was expected of the experiments, they produced the expected results, unconsciously counting non-existent scintillations. To test the technicians, he gave them, without explanation, an unfamiliar experiment. This time, their counts matched his own. Vienna apologized. Hans Geiger, among others, turned back to the electrical counter he had devised with Rutherford in 1908 and improved it. The result, the Geiger counter, was essentially an electrically charged wire strung inside a gas-filled tube with a thinly covered window that allowed charged particles to enter. Once inside the tube, the charged particles ionized gas atoms. The electrons thus stripped from the gas atoms were drawn to the positively charged wire. That changed the current level in the wire. The change, in the form of an electrical pulse, could then be run through an amplifier and converted to a sound, typically a click, or shown as a jump in the sweep of a light beam on the television-like screen of an oscilloscope. The electrical counter could operate continuously and could count above and below the limits possible to fallible physicists peering at scintillation screens. But the early counters had a significant disadvantage. They were highly sensitive to gamma radiation, much more so than zinc sulfide, and the radium compounds the Cavendish used as alpha sources gave off plentiful gamma rays. Polonium, the radioactive element that Marie Curie had discovered in 1898 and named after her native Poland, could be an excellent alternative. It was a good alpha source, and with a gamma ray background 100,000 times less intense than radium, it was much less likely to overload an electrical counter. Unfortunately, polonium was difficult to acquire. A ton of uranium ore contained only about 0.1 gram, too little for commercial separation. It was available practically only as a byproduct of the radioactive decay of radium, and radium, too, was scarce. There was time in those years to recover from the bleakness of war and get on with living. In 1925, Chadwick married Aileen Stewart Brown, daughter of a family long established in business in Liverpool. He had been living at Gonville and Caius College. Now he made plans for permanent residence. A year later, in the midst of house building, when Rutherford asked him and another Cavendish man to take on part of the work of revising Rutherford's old textbook on radioactivity, he fitted in the duty at night, working bundled in an overcoat at a writing table moved close to the fireplace of a drafty temporary rental. When the fire burned low, he even pulled on gloves. At the end of the decade, the Rutherfords suffered a personal tragedy. Their daughter Eileen, 29 years old and the mother of three children, she was married to a theoretician, R.H. Fowler, who kept up that end of physics at the Cavendish, gave birth to a fourth. 1 week later, on December 23rd, she was felled by a lethal blood clot. The loss of his only child, writes A.S. Eve, whom he loved and admired, aged Rutherford for a time. He looked older and stooped more. He continued his life and work with a manful purpose, and one of the delights of his life was his group of four grandchildren. His face always lit up when he spoke of them. Rutherford was elevated to Baron in the New Year's Honors List of 1931, the year he would turn 60. A kiwi crested his armorial bearings. They were supported on the dexter side by a figure representing Hermes Trismegistus, the Egyptian god of wisdom, who was supposed to have written alchemical books, and on the sinister side by a Maori holding a club. And the two crossed curves that quartered his escutcheon traced the matched growth and decay of activity that gives each radioactive element and isotope its characteristic half-life. Around 1928, a German physicist, Walter Botha, a real physicist's physicist to Emilio Segre, and Botha's student, Herbert Becher, began studying the gamma radiation excited by alpha bombardment of light elements. They surveyed the light elements from lithium to oxygen, as well as magnesium, aluminum, and silver. Since they were concentrating on gamma radiation excited from a target, they wanted a minimum gamma background and used a polonium radiation source. I don't know how Botha got his sources, Chadwick puzzles, but he did. Lise Meitner had generously sent polonium to Chadwick from the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, but it was too little to allow Chadwick to do the work Botha was doing. The Germans found gamma excitation with boron, magnesium, and aluminum, as they had more or less expected, because alpha particles disintegrate those elements. But they also, and unexpectedly, found it with lithium and beryllium, which alphas in this reaction did not disintegrate. Indeed, writes Norman Feather, one of Chadwick's colleagues at the Cavendish, with beryllium, the intensity of the radiation was nearly 10 times as great as with any other element investigated. That was strange enough. Equally strange was the oddity that beryllium emitted this intense radiation under alpha bombardment without emitting protons. Botha and Becher reported their results briefly in August 1930, then more fully in December. The radiation they had excited from beryllium had more energy than the bombarding alpha particles. The principle of the conservation of energy required a source for the excess. They proposed that it came from nuclear disintegration despite the absence of protons. Chadwick sent one of his research students, an Australian named H.C. Webster, to work studying these unusual results. A French team began the same study a little later with better resources. Irene Curie, Madame Curie's somber and talented daughter, then 33, and her husband, Frédéric Joliot, 2 years younger, a handsome, outgoing man, trained originally as an engineer, whose charm reminded Segre of the French singer Maurice Chevalier. Marie Curie's Radium Institute at the east end of the Rue Pierre Curie in the Latin Quarter, built just before the war with funds from the French government and the Pasteur Foundation, had the advantage in any studies that required polonium. Radon gas decays over time to 3 only mildly radioactive isotopes, lead-210, bismuth-210, and polonium-210, which thus become available for chemical separation. Medical doctors throughout the world then used radon, sealed into glass ampules, seeds, for cancer treatment. When the radon decayed, which it did in a matter of days, the seeds no longer served. Many physicians sent them on to Paris as a tribute to the woman who discovered radium. They accumulated to the world's largest source of polonium. The Joliot-Curies had worked independently for the 2 years since their marriage in 1927. In 1929, they decided to work in collaboration. They first developed new chemical techniques for separating polonium, and by 1931 had purified a volume of the element almost 10 times more intense than any other existing source. With their powerful new source, they turned their attention to the mystery of beryllium. Chadwick's student, H.C. Webster, had progressed in the meantime, by the late spring of 1931, beyond recapitulation to discovery. He found, says Chadwick, that the radiation from beryllium, which was emitted in the same direction as the alpha particles, was more penetrating than the radiation emitted in a backward direction. Gamma radiation, an energetic form of light, should be emitted equally in every direction from a point source such as a nucleus, just as visible light radiates equally from a light bulb filament. A particle, on the other hand, would usually be bumped forward by an incoming alpha. And that, of course, Chadwick adds, was a point which excited me very much indeed, because I thought, here's the neutron. With twin daughters now, Chadwick had become a family man of regular habits. Among the most sacred of these was his annual June family vacation. The possibility of finding his long-sought neutron was not sufficient cause to change his plans. It might have been, but he thought he needed a cloud chamber for the next step in the search, and the one immediately available to him at the Cavendish was not in working order. He found a cloud chamber in other hands. Its owner agreed to help Webster use it when he had finished using it himself. Still assuming that the neutron was an electron-proton doublet with enough residual electrical charge to ionize a gas at least weakly, Chadwick wanted Webster to aim the beryllium radiation into the cloud chamber and see if he could photograph its ionizing tracks. He left his student to the work and went off on holiday. "Of course," Chadwick said in retrospect of the neutron he was hunting for, "they should not have seen anything in the cloud chamber. Nor did they. They wrote and told me what had happened, that they hadn't found anything, which disappointed me very much." When Webster moved on to the University of Bristol, Chadwick decided to take over the beryllium research himself. First, he had to shift his laboratory to a different part of the Cavendish building, and that delayed him. Then he had to prepare a strong polonium source. In the matter of polonium, he was lucky. Norman Feather had spent the 1929-30 academic year in Baltimore in the physics department at Johns Hopkins, and there befriended an English physician who was in charge of the radium supply at Baltimore's Kelly Hospital. The physician had stored away several hundred used radon seeds. Together, Feather remembers, they contained almost as much polonium as was available to Curie and Joliot in Paris. The hospital donated them to the Cavendish, and Feather brought them home. Chadwick accomplished the dangerous chemical separation that autumn. Irene Joliot-Curie reported her first results to the French Academy of Sciences on December 28, 1931. The beryllium radiation, she found, was even more penetrating than Botta and Becker had reported. She standardized her measurements and put the energy of the radiation at 3 times the energy of the bombarding alpha particle. The Joliot-Curies decided next to see if the beryllium radiation would knock protons out of matter as alpha particles did. They fitted their ionization chamber with a thin window, explains Feather, and placed various materials close to the window in the path of the radiation. They found nothing, except with materials such as paraffin wax and cellophane, which already contained hydrogen in chemical combination. When thin layers of these substances were close to the window, the current in the ionization chamber was greater than usual. By a series of experimental tests, both simple and elegant, they produced convincing evidence that this excess ionization was due to protons ejected from the hydrogenous material. The Joliot-Curies understood then that what they were seeing were elastic collisions, like the collisions of billiard balls or marbles between the beryllium radiation and the nuclei of H atoms. But they were still committed to their previous conviction that the penetrating radiation from beryllium was gamma radiation. They had not thought about the possibility of a neutral particle. They had not read Rutherford's Beckerian lecture, because such lectures were invariably, in their experience, only recapitulations of previously reported work. Rutherford and Chadwick alone had thought seriously about the neutron. On January 18, 1932, the Joliot-Curies reported to the Academy of Sciences their discovery that paraffin wax emitted high-velocity protons when bombarded by beryllium radiation. But that was not the title and the argument of the paper they wrote. They titled their paper, "The Emission of Protons of High Velocity from Hydrogenous Materials Irradiated with Very Penetrating Gamma Rays," which was as unlikely as if a marble should deflect a wrecking ball. Gamma rays could deflect electrons, a phenomenon known as the Compton effect, after its discoverer, the American experimental physicist Arthur Holly Compton. But a proton is 1,836 times heavier than an electron, and not easily moved. At the Cavendish in early February, Chadwick found the Compus Rendus, the French physics journal, in his morning mail, discovered the Joliot-Curie paper, and read it with widening eyes. "Not many minutes afterward, Feather came to my room to tell me about this report, as astonished as I was. A little later that morning, I told Rutherford. It was a custom of long-standing that I should visit him about 11 a.m. to tell him any news of interest and to discuss the work in progress in the laboratory. As I told him about the Curie-Joliot observation and their views on it, I saw his growing amazement. And finally he burst out, "I don't believe it!" Such an impatient remark was utterly out of character, and in all my long association with him, I recall no similar occasion. I mention it to emphasize the electrifying effect of the Curie-Joliot report. Of course, Rutherford agreed that one must believe the observations. The explanation was quite another matter. No further duty interposed itself between Chadwick and his destiny. He went fervently to work, starting on February 7, 1932, a Sunday. It so happened that I was just ready to begin experiment when he read of the Joliot-Curie discovery. I started with an open mind, though naturally my thoughts were on the neutron. I was reasonably sure that the Curie-Joliot observations could not be ascribed to a kind of Compton effect, for I had looked for this more than once. I was convinced that there was something quite new, as well as strange. His simple apparatus consisted of a radiation source and an ionization chamber, the chamber connected to a vacuum tube amplifier and thence to an oscilloscope. The radiation source, an evacuated metal tube strapped to a rough-sawn block of pine, contained a 1 centimeter silver disc coated with polonium, mounted close behind a 2 centimeter disc of pure beryllium, a silver-gray metal that is 3 times as light as aluminum. Alpha particles from the polonium, striking beryllium nuclei, knocked out the penetrating beryllium radiation, which Chadwick found immediately, would pass essentially unimpeded through as much as 2 centimeters of lead. The half-inch opening into the small ionization chamber that faced this radiation source was covered with aluminum foil. Within the shallow chamber, in an atmosphere of air at normal pressure, a small charged plate collected the electrons ionized by incoming radiation and moved their pulses along to the amplifier and oscilloscope. "For the purpose at hand," explains Norman Feather, "such an arrangement was ideal. If the amplifier were carefully designed, it was possible to ensure that the magnitude of the oscillograph deflection was directly proportional to the amount of ionization produced in the chamber. The energy of the recoil atom producing the ionization could thus be calculated directly from the size of the deflection on the oscillograph record." Chadwick mounted a sheet of paraffin 2 millimeters thick in front of the aluminum foil window into the ionization chamber. Immediately, he wrote in his final report on the experiment, "the number of deflections recorded by the oscillograph increased markedly." That showed that particles ejected from the paraffin were entering the chamber. Then he began interposing sheets of aluminum foil between the wax and the chamber window, until no more kicks appeared on the oscilloscope. By scaling the absorptions of aluminum compared to air, he calculated the range of the particles as just over 40 centimeters in air. That range meant it was obvious that the particles were protons. Thus, repeating the Joliot-Curie work prepared the way. Now, Chadwick broke new ground. He removed the paraffin sheet. He wanted to study what happens to other elements bombarded directly by the beryllium radiation. Elements in the form of solids he mounted in front of the chamber window. In this way, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, and nitrogen, as paracyanogen, were tested. Elements in the form of gases he simply pumped into the chamber to replace the ambient air. Hydrogen, helium, nitrogen, oxygen, and argon were examined in this way. In every case, the kicks increased on the oscilloscope. The powerful beryllium radiation knocked protons out of all the elements Chadwick tested. It knocked about the same number out of each element. And most important for his conclusion, the energies of the recoiling protons were significantly greater than they could possibly be if the beryllium radiation consisted of gamma rays. "In general," Chadwick wrote, "the experimental results show that if the recoil atoms are to be explained by collision with a gamma-ray photon, We must assume a larger and larger energy for the photon as the mass of the struck atom increases. Then, quietly, in what in fact is a devastating criticism of the Joliot-Curie thesis, invoking the basic physical rule that no more energy or momentum can come out of an event than went into it, it is evident that we must either relinquish the application of the conservation of energy and momentum in these collisions, or adopt another hypothesis about the nature of the radiation. When they read that sentence, the Joliot-Curies were deeply, and properly, chagrined. The hypothesis Chadwick proposed adopting should come as no surprise. If we suppose that the radiation is not a gamma radiation, but consists of particles of mass very nearly equal to that of the proton, all the difficulties connected with the collisions disappear, both with regard to their frequency and to the energy transfer to different masses. In order to explain the great penetrating power of the radiation, we must further assume that the particle has no net charge. We may suppose it to be the neutron discussed by Rutherford in his Beccarian lecture of 1920. Chadwick then worked the numbers to show that his hypothesis was the correct one to explain the facts. "It was a strenuous time," he said afterward. "From beginning to end, the work took 10 days, and he kept up his Cavendish responsibilities besides. He averaged perhaps 3 hours of sleep a night, labored over the weekend of February 13th through 14th as well, finished probably on the 17th, a Wednesday, the day he sent off a first brief report to Nature to establish priority of discovery. He titled that report, published as a letter to the editor, Possible Existence of a Neutron. But there was no doubt whatever in my mind, or I should not have written the letter." To Chadwick's great credit, writes Segre in tribute, when the neutron was not present in earlier experiments, he did not detect it, and when it ultimately was there, he perceived it immediately, clearly and convincingly. These are the marks of a great experimental physicist. A young Russian, Peter Kapitsa, had come up to Cambridge in 1921 to work at the Cavendish. He was solid, dedicated, charming, and technically inventive, and he soon made himself the apple of Rutherford's eye, the only one among all the boys, even including Chadwick, who could convince the frugal director to allow large sums of money to be spent for apparatus. In 1936, Rutherford would attack Chadwick angrily for encouraging the construction of a cyclotron at the Cavendish. But already in 1932, Kapitsa had a separate laboratory in an elegant new brick building in the Cavendish courtyard for his expensive experiments with powerful magnetic fields. As Kapitsa had settled in at Cambridge, he had noticed what he considered to be an excessive and unproductive deference of British physics students to their seniors. He therefore founded a club, the Kapitsa Club, devoted to open and unhierarchical discussion. Membership was limited and coveted. Members met in college rooms, and Kapitsa frequently opened discussions with deliberate howlers, so that even the youngest would speak up to correct him, loosening the grip of tradition on their necks. That Wednesday, Kapitsa wined and dined the exhausted Chadwick into what Mark Oliphant calls a very mellow mood, then brought him along to a Kapitsa Club meeting. The intense excitement of all in the Cavendish, including Rutherford, Oliphant remembers, was already remarkable, for we had heard rumors of Chadwick's results. Oliphant says Chadwick spoke lucidly and with conviction, not failing to mention the contributions of Botha, Becker, Webster, and the Joliot-Curies. A lesson to us all. C.P. Snow, who was also present, remembers the performance as one of the shortest accounts ever made about a major discovery. When tall and bird-like Chadwick finished speaking, he looked over the assembly and announced abruptly, "Now I want to be chloroformed and put to bed for a fortnight." He deserved his rest. He had discovered a new elementary particle, the third basic constituent of matter. It was this neutral mass that compounded the weight of the elements without adding electrical charge. Two protons and two neutrons made a helium nucleus. 7 protons and 7 neutrons a nitrogen, 47 protons and 60 neutrons a silver, 56 protons and 81 neutrons a barium, 92 protons and 146 or 143 neutrons a uranium. And because the neutron was as massive as a proton, but carried no electrical charge, it was hardly affected by the shell of electrons around a nucleus, nor did the electrical barrier of the nucleus itself block its way. It would therefore serve as a new nuclear probe of surpassing power of penetration. A beam of thermal neutrons, writes the American theoretical physicist Philip Morrison, moving at about the speed of sound, which corresponds to a kinetic energy of only about a 40th of an electron volt, produces nuclear reactions in many materials much more easily than a beam of protons of millions of volts energy, traveling thousands of times faster. Ernest Lawrence's cyclotron, spiraling protons to million-volt energies for the first time the same month that Chadwick made his fateful discovery, fortunately proved to be adaptable to the production of neutrons. More than any other development, Chadwick's neutron made practical the detailed examination of the nucleus. Hans Bethe once remarked that he considered everything before 1932 the prehistory of nuclear physics, and from 1932 on, the history of nuclear physics. The difference, he said, was the discovery of the neutron. Word of the discovery reached Copenhagen in the midst of preparations for an amateur theatrical, a parody of Goethe's Faust, to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the opening of Bohr's Institute for Theoretical Physics. The postdoctoral dramatists gave the new particle the last word. They had cast Wolfgang Pauli, a corpulent man with a smooth, round face and protuberant, heavy-lidded eyes, who resembled the actor Peter Lorre, as Mephistopheles, Bohr as the Lord. Eclectically, they cast Chadwick in absentia as Wagner, and an anonymous illustrator drew him into the script, the personification of the ideal experimentalist, according to the stage directions, balancing a vastly magnified neutron on his finger. In Copenhagen, as before in Cambridge, Chadwick reports his discovery briefly and succinctly. "The neutron has come to be. Loaded with mass is he, of charge forever free. Pauli, do you agree?" Pauli steps forward to dispense his Mephistophelian blessing. "That which experiment has found, though theory has no part in, is always reckoned more than sound to put your mind and heart in." And a chorus of clowning, friendly physicists, Bohr's brilliant young crew, dances out to sing a finale and bring the curtain down. "Now a reality, once but a vision. What classicality, grace, and precision, hailed with cordiality, honored in song, eternal neutrality pulls us along." It was the last peaceful time many of them would know for years to come. 7. Exodus. Anti-Semitism is strong here, and political reaction is violent, Albert Einstein wrote Paul Ehrenfest from Berlin in December 1919. The letter coincides with Einstein's discovery by the popular press, the beginning of his years of international celebrity. A new figure in world history, the Berliner Illustrierte Zeitung described him under a cover photograph on December 14th. Whose investigations signify a complete revision of our concepts of nature and are on a par with the insights of a Copernicus, a Kepler, a Newton. Immediately, the anti-Semites and fascists set to work on him. Einstein was already, at 43, respected in the first rank of theoretical physicists. He had been nominated for the Nobel Prize in all but 2 years since 1910, the secondings increasing in number after 1917. Max Planck, who was not given to exaggeration, wrote the Nobel Committee in 1919 that Einstein made the first step beyond Newton. The award might have come sooner than in 1922, belatedly for 1921. The 1922 prize was Bohr's. had relativity been less paradoxical a revelation. Physically, Einstein was not yet the amused, grandfatherly notable of his later American years. His mustache was still dark, and his thick black hair had only begun to gray. C.P. Snow would observe a massive body, very heavily muscled. The Swabian-born physicist's friends thought his loud laugh boyish. His enemies thought it rude. A powerful sensuality, Snow suspected, suspecting also that Einstein took his sensuality to be one of the chains of personality that ought to be slipped off. Nor had he yet learned, in the psychoanalyst Eric Erickson's words, to look into cameras as if he were meeting the eye of the future beholders of his image. In the past year, Einstein had endured a stomach ulcer, jaundice, and a painful divorce. He had lost and partly regained 56 pounds. His mother was dying of cancer. Fatigue stained his expressive face. Leopold Infeld, a young Polish physicist who knocked at his door in post-war Berlin seeking a letter of recommendation, found him dressed in a morning coat and striped trousers with one important button missing. Infeld knew Einstein's face from magazines and newsreels, but no picture could reproduce the shining glow of his eyes. They were large and dark brown, and the diffident young visitor was one of many. Leo Szilard was another, who found comfort in those cold days in their honest warmth. The immediate occasion for world notice was an eclipse of the sun. Einstein had presented a paper to the Prussian Academy of Sciences in Berlin on November 25, 1915. The field equations of gravitation, in which, he reported happily, finally, the general theory of relativity is closed as a logical structure. The paper stands as his first finished statement of the general theory. It was susceptible of proof. It explained mysterious anomalies in the orbit of Mercury. That confirmed prediction was the one which left Einstein feeling something had snapped in him. The general theory also predicted that starlight would be deflected when it passed a massive body like the sun through an angle equal to twice the value Newtonian theory predicts. The Great War delayed measurement of the Einsteinian value. A total eclipse of the sun, which would block the sun's glare and make the stars beyond it visible, due on May 29, 1919, offered the first post-war occasion. The British, not the Germans, followed through. Cambridge astronomer Arthur Stanley Eddington led an expedition to Principe Island off the West African coast. The Greenwich Observatory sent another expedition to Sobral, inland from the coast of northern Brazil. A joint meeting of the Royal Society and the Royal Astronomical Society at Burlington House in London on November 6th, under a portrait of Newton, confirmed the stunning results. The Einstein value, not the Newton value, held good. "One of the greatest achievements in the history of human thought," J.J. Thompson told the assembled worthies. "It is not the discovery of an outlying island, but of a whole continent of new scientific ideas." That was news. The Times headlined it, "Revolution in Science," and the word spread. From that day forward, Einstein was a marked man. It rankled German chauvinists, including rightist students and some physicists, that the eyes of the world should turn to a Jew who had declared himself a pacifist during the bloodiest of nationalistic wars, and who spoke out for internationalism now. When Einstein prepared to offer a series of popular lectures in the University of Berlin's largest hall, everyone was lecturing on relativity that winter, students complained of the expense for coal and electricity. The student body president challenged Einstein to hire his own hall. He ignored the insult and spoke in the university hall as scheduled, but at least one of his lectures, in February, was disrupted. He was challenged more seriously the following August by an organization assembled under the obscure leadership and extravagant but clandestine financing that called itself the Committee of German Scientists for the Preservation of Pure Scholarship. The 1905 Nobel laureate, Philippe Lenard, seeing relativity hailed and Einstein come to fame, retreated into a vindictive anti-Semitism and lent his respectability to the committee, which attacked relativity theory as a Jewish corruption and Einstein as a tasteless self-promoter. The organization held a well-attended public meeting in Berlin's Philharmonic Hall on August 20th. Einstein went to listen. One speaker, as Leopold Infeld recalled, said that uproar about the theory of relativity was hostile to the German spirit, and stayed to scorn the crackpot talk with laughter and satiric applause. The criticism nevertheless stung. Einstein mistakenly thought the majority of his German colleagues subscribed to it. Rashly, he struck off an uncharacteristically defensive statement. It appeared in the Berliner Tagblatt 3 days after the Philharmonic Hall meeting. "My answer to the Anti-Relativity Theory Company Limited" shocked his friends, but it presciently identified the deeper issues of the committee attack. I have good reason to believe that motives other than a desire to search for truth are at the bottom of their enterprise, Einstein wrote, and parenthetically, leaving his implications unstated in Elysian. Were I a German national, with or without swastika, instead of a Jew liberal, international disposition, then... A month later, his sense of humor had returned. He asked Max Born not to be too hard on him. Everyone has to sacrifice at the altar of stupidity from time to time, and this I have done with my article. But before then, he had seriously considered leaving Germany. It would not be the first time. Einstein had renounced German citizenship and departed the country once before, at the extraordinary age of 16. That earlier rejection, which he reversed 2 decades later, prepared him for the final one, after the Weimar interlude, when Adolf Hitler came to power. Germany had been united in empire for only 8 years when Einstein was born in Ulm on March 14, 1879. He grew up in Munich. He was slow to speak, but he was not, as legend has it, slow in his studies. He consistently earned the highest or next highest marks in mathematics and Latin in school and gymnasium. At 4 or 5, the miracle of a compass his father showed him excited him so much, he remembered, that he trembled and grew cold. It seemed to him then that there had to be something behind objects that lay deeply hidden. He would look for the something which objects hid, though his particular genius was to discover that there was nothing behind them to hide, that objects, as matter and as energy, were all, that even space and time were not the invisible matrices of the material world, but its attributes. "If you will not take the answer too seriously," he told a clamorous crowd of reporters in New York in 1921, who asked him for a short explanation of relativity, "and consider it only as a kind of joke, then I can explain it as follows. It was formerly believed that if all material things disappeared out of the universe, time and space would be left. According to the relativity theory, however, time and space disappear together with the things." The quiet child became a rebellious adolescent. He was working his own way through Kant and Darwin and mathematics, while the gymnasium pounded him with rote. He veered off into religion, Judaism, and came back bitterly disillusioned. "Through the reading of popular scientific books, I soon reached the conviction that much of the stories in the Bible could not be true. The consequence was a positively fanatic free thinking, coupled with the impression that youth is intentionally being deceived by the state through lies. It was a crushing impression. Suspicion against every kind of authority grew out of this experience, a skeptical attitude towards the convictions which were alive in any specific social environment." His father stumbled in business, not for the first time. The family moved across the Alps to Milan to start again, but Albert stayed behind in a boarding house to complete his gymnasium work. He was probably expelled from the gymnasium before he could quit, He acquired a doctor's certificate claiming nervous disorders. It was not only the autocracy of his German school that he despised. Politically, he wrote later, I hated Germany from my youth. He had thought of renouncing his citizenship while his family was still in Munich as a rebellious adolescent of 15. That began a long family debate. He won it after he moved from Milan to Zurich to try again to finish his schooling. His father wrote the German authorities on his behalf. Einstein renounced his German citizenship officially on January 28, 1896. The Swiss took him aboard in 1901. He liked their doughty democracy and was prepared to serve in their militia, but was found medically unfit because of flat feet and varicose veins. But one reason he quit Germany was to avoid the duty of Prussian conscription, Kadavergehorsamkeit, the obedience of the corpse. The boy and the young man rebelled to protect the child within. The victorious child, Erik Erikson has it in Einstein's case, the child with its uninhibited creativity preserved into adulthood. Einstein grazes the point in a letter to James Franck. I sometimes ask myself how it came about that I was the one to develop the theory of relativity. The reason, I think, is that a normal adult never stops to think about problems of space and time. These are things which he has thought of as a child. But my intellectual development was retarded, as a result of which I began to wonder about space and time only when I had already grown up. Relativity was a misnomer. Einstein worked his way to a new physics by demanding consistency and greater objectivity of the old. If the speed of light is a constant, then something else must serve as the elastic between two systems at motion in relation to one another, even if that something else is time. If a body gives off an amount, E, of energy, its mass minutely diminishes. But if energy has mass, then mass must have energy. The two must be equivalent. E equals mc squared. E divided by c squared equals m. That is, an amount of energy E in joules is equal to an amount of mass m in kilograms multiplied by the square of the speed of light, an enormous number, 3 times 10 to the 8th meters per second times 3 times 10 to the 8th meters per second equals 9 times 10 to the 16th, or 90 quintillion joules per kilogram. Dividing E by C squared demonstrates how large an amount of energy is contained within even a small mass. Einstein came to that beautiful, harrowing equivalency in 1907 in a long paper published in the Jahrbuch der Radioaktivität und Elektronik. It is possible, he wrote there, that radioactive processes may become known in which a considerably larger percentage of the mass of the initial atom is converted into radiations of various kinds than is the case for radium. Like Soddy and Rutherford earlier in England, he saw the lesson of radium, that there was vast energy stored in matter, though he was not at all sure that it could be released, even experimentally. The line of thought is amusing and fascinating, he confided to a friend at the time. But I wonder if the dear Lord laughs about it and has led me around by the nose. He had his PhD then from the University of Zurich, and Max Planck had begun to correspond with him. But he had not yet left the patent office where he worked as a technical expert from 1902 to 1909, the years of his first great burst of papers, including those on Brownian motion, the photoelectric effect, and special relativity. He habilitated as a Privatdozent at the University of Bern in 1908, but he held on to the patent office job for another year for security. Finally, in October 1909, after receiving his first honorary doctorate, he moved up to associate professor at the University of Zurich. A full professorship enticed him to isolated Prague. He was married now, with a wife and 2 sons to support. But happily, the Polytechnic in Zurich drew him back a year later with a matching offer. The academic hesitations measure how radically new was his work. It was 1913 before Max Planck, Fritz Haber, and a muster of German notables, recognizing the waste, offered him a triple appointment in Berlin: a research position under the aegis of the Prussian Academy of Sciences, a research professorship at the university, and the directorship of the planned Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physics. After the Germans left, Einstein quipped to his assistant, Otto Stern, that they were like men looking for a rare postage stamp. He arrived in Berlin in April 1914. In the war years, separated from his first wife and living alone, he completed the general theory. To Max Born, that great work of art was the greatest feat of human thinking about nature, the most amazing combination of philosophical penetration, physical intuition, and mathematical skill, even though its connections with experience were slender. Einstein's crowning achievement ameliorated for him the universal madness of the war. I began to feel comfortable amid the present insane tumult, in conscious detachment from all things which preoccupy the crazy community. Why should one not be able to live contentedly as a member of the service personnel in the lunatic asylum? After all, one respects the lunatics as the people for whom the building in which one lives exists. Up to a point, you can make your own choice of institution, though the distinction between them is smaller than you think in your younger years. Einstein raised funds for the Zionist cause of a Hebrew university in Palestine on a first trip to the United States with Chaim Weizmann in April and May 1921. He had seen the crowds of Eastern Jews stumbling into Berlin in the wake of war and revolution, watched the German incitement against them, and decided to take their part. His guide to Zionist thinking was the eloquent spokesman and organizer Kurt Blumenfeld, who also served in that capacity to the young Hannah Arendt. It was Blumenfeld who convinced him to accompany Weizmann to America. His relations with the forceful, single-minded Weizmann, Einstein told Abraham Pais once, were, as Freud would say, ambivalent. He lectured on relativity at Columbia, the City College of New York, and Princeton, met Fiorella LaGuardia and President Warren G. Harding, conceived a new theory of eternity, sitting through formal speeches at the annual dinner of the National Academy of Sciences, and spoke to crowds of enthusiastic American Jews. Back home, he wrote, he first discovered the Jewish people in America. I have seen any number of Jews, but the Jewish people I have never met either in Berlin or elsewhere in Germany. The Jewish people which I found in America came from Russia, Poland, and Eastern Europe, generally. These men and women still retain a healthy national feeling. It has not yet been destroyed by the process of atomization and dispersion. The statement implicitly criticizes the Jews of Germany, whose undignified assimilationist cravings and strivings, Einstein wrote elsewhere, had always annoyed him. Blumenfeld propounded a radical post-assimilatory Zionism and had taught him well. A decade later, Hannah Arendt would write that, in a society on the whole hostile to Jews, it is possible to assimilate only by assimilating to anti-Semitism also. Einstein specialized in driving assumptions to their logical conclusions. Clearly, he had arrived at a similar understanding of the Jewish question. He was now not only the most famous scientist in the world, but also a known spokesman for Jewish causes. In Berlin, on June 24, 1922, right-wing extremists gunned down Walter Rathenau, the Weimar Republic's first foreign minister. A physical chemist and industrialist friend of Einstein, and a highly visible Jew. It appeared that Einstein might be next. I am supposed to belong to that group of persons whom the people are planning to assassinate, he wrote Max Planck. I have been informed independently by serious persons that it would be dangerous for me in the near future to stay in Berlin, or for that matter, to appear anywhere in public in Germany. He lived privately until October, then left with his second wife, Elsa, on a long trip to the Far East and Japan, receiving notice of his Nobel Prize en route. He spent 12 days in Palestine on the way back and stopped over in Spain. By the time he returned to Berlin, German preoccupation with politics had temporarily retreated behind preoccupation with the Dadaistic mark, then soaring toward 54,000 to the dollar. Einstein went on with his work, including the Einstein-Szilard refrigerator pump and his first efforts toward a unified field theory, but began frequently to travel abroad. The anti-Semitism Einstein found strong in Berlin in December 1919 was rampant in Munich. Pale, thin, 30-year-old Adolf Hitler sat down that month at the single battered table in the cramped office of the German Workers' Party, formerly a tap room, to draft his party's platform. A grotesque wood carving served as inspiration. It would follow its master into history. A touring Australian academic encountered it again in 1936. I was being shown round a famous collection of Nazi Party relics in Munich. The curator was a mild old man, a student of the old German academic class. After showing me everything, he led, almost with bated breath, to his pièce de résistance. He produced a small, sculptured wooden gibbet, from which was suspended a brutally realistic figure of a dangling Jew. This piece of humorless sadism, he said, decorated the table at which Hitler founded the party 17 years ago. His pale blue eyes shining, Hitler read out the 25 points of his party's program the following February in the Festsaal of Munich's Hofbrauhaus, before nearly 2,000 people, the largest crowd the little German Workers' Party had yet attracted. "These points of ours," he had shouted in triumph the day he finished drafting them, "are going to rival Luther's placard on the doors of Wittenberg." All or part of six of them applied specifically to Jews. That Jews were not countrymen of German blood, and therefore could not be citizens. That only citizens could hold public office or publish German-language newspapers. That no more non-Germans might immigrate into the country, and that all non-Germans, admitted since the beginning of the Great War, should be expelled. The 25 points were never officially declared the program of the Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, the Nazi Party, which the German Workers' Party evolved to, but their power was felt nevertheless. The Beer Hall Putsch on November 8, 1923, delivered Hitler to a comfortable, sunlit cell in Landsberg prison, where he dictated his personal and political testament to his bashful acolyte Rudolf Hess. Mein Kampf has much to say about the Jews. Across the nearly 700 pages of its two volumes, it refers to Jewry more frequently than to any other subject except Marxism. And Hitler considered Marxism a Jewish invention and a Jewish weapon. Jews, the future Chancellor of Germany declares in Mein Kampf, are no lovers of water. He often grew sick to my stomach from their smell. Their dress is unclean, their appearance generally unheroic. A foreign people. They have definite racial characteristics. They are inferior beings. Vampires with poisoned fangs, yellow fists, and repulsive traits. The personification of the devil as the symbol of all evil assumes the living shape of the Jew. The attributes of the Jew are legion, Hitler goes on. The Jew is a garbage separator, splashing his filth in the face of humanity, or he is a scribbler who poisons men's souls like germ carriers of the worst sort. Or the cold-hearted, shameless, and calculating director of this revolting vice, traffic in the scum of the big city. Was there any form of filth or profligacy, Hitler asks rhetorically, without at least one Jew involved in it? If you cut even cautiously into such an abscess, you found, like a maggot in a rotting body, often dazzled by the sudden light, a kike. The Jew is no German. Jews are a race of dialectical liars, a people which lives only for this earth,
the great masters of the lie, traitors, profiteers, usurers, and swindlers, a world hydra, a horde of rats, alone in this world they would stifle in filth and offal. Without any true culture, the Jew is a parasite on the body of other peoples, a sponger who, like a noxious bacillus, keeps spreading as soon as a favorable medium invites him. He lacks idealism in any form. He is an eternal bloodsucker of diabolical purposes, restrained by no moral scruples, who poisons the blood of others but preserves his own. He systematically ruins women and girls. With satanic joy on his face, the black-haired Jewish youth lurks in wait for the unsuspecting girl whom he defiles with his blood, thus stealing her from her people. He is master over bastards and bastards alone. And it was and is Jews who bring the Negroes into the Rhineland, always with the same secret thought and clear aim of ruining the hated white race by the necessarily resulting bastardization. Syphilis is a Jewish disease, a Jewification of our spiritual life and mammonization of our mating instinct that will sooner or later destroy our entire offspring. The Jew makes a mockery of natural feelings, overthrows all concepts of beauty and sublimity, of the noble and the good, and instead drags men down into the sphere of his own base nature, an apparition in a black kaftan and black hair locks, responsible for spiritual pestilence worse than the Black Death of olden times. The Jew is a coward, a plunderer, a menace, a foreign element, a viper, a tyrant, a ferment of decomposition. The sun shines in the wide windows of Hitler's cell at Landsberg. Boyish in Lederhosen, he remembers that he was blinded by mustard gas below Ypres. He wrote a poem during the war, a poem out of a dream, before he took shrapnel in the thigh on the Somme, before Ypres. I often go on bitter nights to Wotan's oak in the quiet glade, with dark powers to weave a union. The runic letters of the moon makes with its magic spell, and all who are full of impudence during the day are made small by the magic formula. Hitler's testament is almost finished. He dictates, his blanched face tumefying, if at the beginning of the war and during the war, 12 or 15,000 of these Hebrew corruptors of the people had been held under poisoned gas, as happened to hundreds of thousands of our very best German workers in the field, the sacrifice of millions at the front would not have been in vain. The dispersion of the Jewish people from Palestine, the diaspora, began in the 6th century BC, when Babylon conquered the southern Palestinian kingdom of Judah, destroyed Solomon's temple, and carried a large body of Jews into captivity. By the beginning of the Christian era, under Roman hegemony, Jews had established communities in Egypt, in Greece, around the Mediterranean and on the shores of the Black Sea, and there were Jewish slaves with the Roman legions on the Rhine. Conditions worsened again for the Jews when the empire was Christianized in the 4th century AD with the conversion of the Emperor Constantine. Christianity and Judaism competed in a Darwinian sense for the same holy land and the same holy books. Under systematic persecution,